family requires that you, number one, be a clear authority figure. In a phenomenal family, you as a parent are not really your child's friend, nor are you their equal. You can be friendly, and should be, but you never blur the boundary. Your children need you to be an authority figure who lets them know where the boundaries of acceptable behavior lie. Trying to be their friends will only undermine your authority. When you inevitably must shift from the role of friend to the role of parent in order to discipline your child, it can be very confusing and leave them feeling betrayed. I thought you were my friend, and now you ground me or take away my toys? You see, it just doesn't work. You're either a parent or a friend. You cannot be both. Number two, make the decisions for your family. When all is said and done, the final decisions rest with you. My own family is very democratic. We take into consideration everyone's opinion. But when it comes time to make a decision, we do not manage by committee. Robin and I make the final call. Number three, never play favorites. No child stands above another, and as a parent, you should never play favorites. Children sense favoritism, and they often interpret it as a lack of love. It leaves a residue that can show up later as low self-esteem. So the message should be obvious. A spirit of acceptance is a core requirement for nurturing and building a phenomenal family. When you exhibit a spirit that says you accept your children, you're saying that even though you may not always rubber stamp things your kids are doing, you do love them. You're saying that despite all the things you sometimes wish they would do or wouldn't do, the bottom line is that you accept who they are, and you will always be there for them. When children live with acceptance, approval, and praise, they learn to like themselves, they learn to have faith in themselves, and they learn to love. Factor number two of the five factors for a phenomenal family: promote rhythm in your family life. One of the major themes you'll hear me repeat throughout this book is that the phenomenal family has a certain rhythm, a beat that communicates, this is where we're from, this is what we stand for, and this is what we do together. Life begins with this rhythm. An unborn child senses the tympanic sounds of his mother's heartbeat in the womb, a calming and comforting sound that continues after birth when she holds her infant instinctively over her heart, an example of the natural order of the universe. It's this beat of life that provides the comfort, the surety, and the security that nurtures us and helps us grow, and then connects us to a deeper rhythm of life within our family. Children need this rhythm in their lives, and it's unsettling to them when they don't have it. This factor is absolutely critical to the well-being of your family. Every family has a uniquely different rhythm. A family with six children has a very different rhythm than the family with one child. If you compared the family living at number 6 Elm Street, USA to the family living at number 7 Elm Street, USA, you would hear a different rhythm, just as you would hear a different rhythm while listening to two different songs. Although they both may be wonderful songs, each is distinctly different. In some families, the rhythm might be heavy metal, whereas in others, it might be the rhythm of smooth jazz. But not all rhythms are good rhythms. They can be defined by chaos, pain, stress, hurt, and discord, paranoia, lack of trust, pain, dissension, or deteriorating relationship standards. It's a dark rhythm. That could be the rhythm of your family. If you can't find your rhythm or you don't like the rhythm, how do you change it or create a new one? Let the following notes help define for you the rhythm in your family, and how to restore it. Create a predictable pace of family life. I know it's difficult to schedule the events of the day or the week, but your family does need a pace, a rate of progress throughout the day built around key activities. For example, set specific times for when meals are served, Have regular bedtimes. Establish a specific list of chores. Have certain times for homework, television, internet use, and so forth. The constancy of these things provides a cohesive dimension of family life that everyone can depend on. That predictability can have a very settling and calming effect. Play games and do activities as a family. Children are naturally inventive and enjoy family games. By having a regular game or puzzle night each week, you give your family a positive structure, something everyone begins to look forward to, and you create opportunities for connection and communication. By the way, watching TV or a movie is not a family activity because it requires no interaction. Develop volunteer projects together. Get your family involved in church, at a shelter, or in some other charitable activity on a regular basis. Whatever you do, turn the concept of giving into a proactive behavior. When you do, this will give your children a tremendous sense of accomplishment, and the value of giving will become so woven into the fabric of your family that it will define who your family is and what it stands for. Reinforce your family's values. These are foundational convictions for which your family stands, convictions that you live by, not some of the time, but all of the time. By acknowledging and living your values, you bring this much-needed rhythm into your life. One way to do this is to give a voice to your values through an ongoing dialogue in order to reinforce what your family embraces and holds dear. For example, Robin and I have always defined for our sons what it means to be a McGraw. We say things such as, "The McGraws don't lie, steal, cheat, call people names, make racist comments, or be mean to other people. The McGraws don't make fun of people who are physically challenged, and we don't talk about or be disrespectful to neighbors or elderly people." You should explain to your children why your family does not do those things, why they are unacceptable. You can explain it by saying that it isn't fair or right. It isn't something that you can be proud of, or that maybe it's just simply not productive. Create a sense of your family's identity. One way to do this is to research your family tree. Too often, great family stories are forgotten and people cease to exist in our memories as a result. Make it a project to learn about previous generations, including those who have passed away. Who knows, you might be related to someone famous or even infamous. Understanding your family history strengthens the bond among family members. Establish standards of conduct. There are probably some things that your family does consistently embrace and repeat, and these are part of your standards of conduct. Many of these standards should be pretty fixed and not open for constant discussion. For example, from the time I was 3 years old, my father always told me, "Son, when you meet somebody, you step up, call them by name, look them in the eye, and give them a firm handshake." So if someone came to our house or met us on the street, I knew exactly what I was supposed to do. I wasn't lost, I wasn't intimidated or confused, I knew exactly what I was supposed to do, and so it took the pressure off of me. As children, we were taught lessons in manners and self-restraint. We had a rhythm in our family of always saying please and thank you, respecting one another's privacy, asking permission to go into someone's room, and showing respect for one another were all standards of conduct that we lived. A family with standards of conduct is a well-functioning family. Be accountable for your choices. You and everybody else in your family are fully accountable for the choices all of you make. The choices you make and continue to make are 100% your responsibility, and there is a cost of those choices, good or bad, to those with whom you share your life, because your choices affect everyone else. Remember my earlier point about how we all get painted with each other's brush? You choose the attitudes you bring into your family relationships. You choose the emotions and feelings that will control your behavior in the family. And you choose how you act and how you react to everyone else in the family. Your choices affect your interactions with everyone else in your family. Genuinely acknowledging your accountability and how your choices affect other members of your family means that you should be willing to ask yourself questions like the following. Are there certain behaviors or bad habits I need to stop? If so, what are they? Do I spend more money than I can afford, possibly jeopardizing the financial condition of my family? Do I choose to live recklessly and without regard for my personal safety? Am I having trouble at work brought on by my own attitudes or behavior or by compromising my principles? Do I consider the consequences, positive or negative, of a career change on my family? Have I taken unnecessary risk? Have I in any way treated my children unfairly? Am I failing to take care of my health by simply not requiring enough of myself? Have I failed to take my marriage vows seriously, being emotionally unavailable or even unfaithful? Have I considered how this behavior may affect my family? Do I choose to put work over the priority of family? Answer these questions and any others that may come to mind so as to see how your choices have the power to impact your family. Let your answers identify for you what must become priorities for repair. Stand up for your family and everyone in it. In a phenomenal family, family comes first. Therefore, loyalty is critical in establishing rhythm in a family. You don't forsake your family because of your boyfriend, your girlfriend, or any of your friends. There's no them versus us scenario, it's just us. Certainly, you should support your child's loyalty to the teams they play on, the choirs they're members of, all the subgroups that they belong to. But it is a different degree of loyalty than that which you want them to have with your family. Your primary sense of belonging comes from your family, and that's what you want your children to feel. They cannot serve two masters. You cannot have divided loyalties. Family comes first above all else. I once worked with a troubled family whose brother became heavily involved in drugs, got busted for dealing, and was sent to prison. The family was embarrassed by his criminal acts, particularly it was tough on his sister. My message to her was, be loyal to your brother. Don't be ashamed that he's your brother. If someone says to you, "Oh, isn't your brother in prison?" respond by saying, "Yes, he is. He made some really bad choices, and now he's paying for it, and I'm really pulling for him to turn his life around." Loyalty begins at home. Family members make sacrifices for one another. They stick up for one another in front of others. They stand by their family. Friends come and go, but you have only one family, and it will be yours forever. Suppose there is a flat note in the rhythm of your family, a workaholic father, a partner who doesn't support your desire to create a healthy family, or a parent with a darker side. Creating the right rhythm does not require both parents' participation. In a perfect world, absolutely. But don't wait for your partner. The change begins with you as you decide what to do with your family. By breaking the stalemate of sitting around and waiting to see who's going to make a move first, you can create the energy and the newness. Your constructive thinking will be infectious to everyone around you, especially your partner. What you hope for is that through your discussions, through your examples, and through your choices, you'll be an inspiration for everyone else in your family. You need to reclaim and find the rhythm for your own family, one in which there are positive patterns such as discipline that establishes order and not oppression, an atmosphere that motivates and inspires change, and values that uphold and define who you are as a family and what you believe. Most importantly, A family with rhythm is one where you, as parents, live the love you say you feel. Factor number three, establish meaningful rituals and traditions. Whether it was the traditional family dinners you enjoyed at your grandparents or the vacations you took every year with your parents, we all remember events and celebrations that define who we are as a family and how we are connected to each other. What I'm talking about here are predictable activities and patterns in your family life that serve as psychological and behavioral anchors for your values and beliefs. They provide your family with a sense of stability and identity, reinforce your family's heritage, give your family meaning, and continue to create rhythm in your family's life. For example, your family may celebrate rite of passage rituals such as baptism or bar mitzvahs, bedtime rituals of a bath followed by story time, or milestone rituals such as special ways of celebrating birthdays and wedding anniversaries. There are also affiliation rituals in which we identify with institutions, groups, and with things larger than ourselves. Rooting for your favorite sports team or standing shoulder to shoulder with other members of the community and watching 4th of July fireworks are examples of what I'm talking about. By definition, family rituals are activities that are repeated, deliberate, coordinated, and have meaning. You make a commitment to do these activities. You don't do them only when they're convenient and blow them off when they're not. The power of rituals and traditions is found in their repetition. Without these defining characteristics, a ritual falls to the level of just being a routine and it loses its power. To help frame this concept more clearly, allow me to share with you some rituals from my own family life. When I used to put my sons Jay and Jordan to bed at night, after Robin had done the hard work all day long, I'd tell them a fictional story that always starred them and made them the conquering heroes of the tale. Once upon a time, there was a huge mountain, I'd begin, and at the top of that mountain lived a little boy, and his name was Jordan. My story would slowly unravel, telling of their adventures, their bravery, and other qualities to inspire my young sons. Then, after the storytelling was over, I'd always ask the question, how do you suppose, out of all the little boys in the world, I got the best one? Jay and Jordan would both always giggle, saying, I don't know, Dad. To this very day, these bedtime rituals remain crystal clear in my son's memories. For the three of us, these were rituals of connection. Now, here's my point. Rituals like these help your children acquire a sense of continuity, security, and feeling loved, particularly in today's world where there's so much family brokenness and emotional distance, and a pace that's literally a blur of hyperactivity, diversion, and distraction, and what I call living in the laser lane. Holidays, vacations, family reunions, or other special events that bring families together are examples of traditions. Traditions aren't meaningless habits or ways of doing things. Like rituals, they create a sense of identity and a sense of belonging among family members. Ever since our sons were old enough to have even a small vocabulary, Robin and I have had the tradition of making a Christmas Eve videotape about the impending visit of Santa Claus, highlights of the previous year, and what each boy hopes and expects to get for Christmas. We always had a little rocking chair that we'd put the boys in, and we'd place a Christmas hat on their heads and interview them on camera. Often they'd dance or hop around, sing or dodge the camera. That was their personality at the time. As they got older, they'd roll their eyes and give smart-aleck answers on camera, but they still loved this family tradition. Our family rituals and traditions are one of the ways we've created a warm, loving, and nurturing environment for our family. So important in family life are rituals and traditions that social scientists tell us that without them, a family may be lacking in crucial ways. Your children are more likely to develop behavioral problems, you'll experience more conflict in your home, and in general, you'll create less family stability. What's more, rituals have been found to produce positive changes in the physical body in the form of stronger immunity, lower levels of stress hormones, and reduced blood pressure. Don't think that there's some etched-in-stone way to do rituals and traditions. There isn't, and it isn't brain surgery. There can be as many different ways to create rituals and traditions as there are different families who observe them. One way is not better than another. Here are some ways to establish rituals and traditions in your own family. Plan purposeful celebrations. Birthdays, Father's Day, Mother's Day, July 4th, and other events are all opportunities to create a tradition or even a ritual. These are times that have specific meaning that pertain directly to your family members. Don't shortchange them. Invest your time and effort in a meaningful celebration. During the holidays, create traditions by baking an apple cake every year or decorating the tree with the same ornaments. Play the same music at birthday parties. Make sure your children either buy or make their own gifts. If you do it for them, you cheat them out of being an active participant in the ritual. You don't even have to wait for those annual events. Create a monthly celebration, such as a I'm glad we made it to the end of the month party, or project wrap-up party. Hold naming rituals. In most native cultures, young people undergo a coming-of-age ritual that often includes choosing a new name. Naming a baby blesses that child and welcomes him or her into a family and a community. Renaming rituals allow the individual to connect with and express what is at the heart of who he or she is. You can still do something like this with your children today. When a child gets older and wants to be called by a mature name, for example, it's perfectly okay to say, you can be called Kathleen now instead of Kathy, or Robert instead of Bobby. Tell family stories. Whether they are about the family events or some related events, family stories are a vehicle by which each generation learns to care about the previous ones. Build into family get-togethers special times for retelling of these stories, complete with slides, pictures, and mementos. Bring out picture albums or old films to enhance the storytelling experience. Create special dinner time rituals. To increase communication at the dinner table, make time for each person in the family to share two good things that happened to them that day and two things that maybe weren't so good. This is an excellent way for family members to open themselves up to one another and serves to bring everyone closer together. Worship together. For many families, attending a worship service is a major family ritual. Religious services connect families with a special community of belief and support, as well as with a higher power, and provide an experience to be together. Family participation in worship services is an excellent way to enact a family's faith through rituals and lay a spiritual foundation for your children. What is important is that you find ways of being together that work for your family. Whether or not it meets some standard that you read in a book or conforms to what your neighbors do should not matter. The litmus test should be whether or not what you're doing as a family generates the results of togetherness, communication, continuity, and bonding. It's not important that you follow particular principles. It is important that the principles work and that you write your own rules. Focus on what works for your family. Factor number 4, be active in your communication. The greatest things you can give your children are your ear and your voice. When my son Jay asked teens across the country what they wanted most from their parents, the number one answer was to have their parents more involved in their lives. They don't want to be interrogated, just talked to. That is why, at the heart of a phenomenal family, there is active communication. What I'm talking about is meaningful dialogue that takes into account each family member's need for acceptance, self-respect, encouragement, and security, and seeks to serve those needs as part of a daily practice. When you actively communicate, you listen with the goal of understanding. Respond in a non-judgmental way. Share information openly and honestly, and do so in a way that keeps your family relationships on solid, loving ground. Unfortunately, though, the agenda of a vast majority of family communications these days has become problem-driven. Even in the strongest of families, too often people talk about nothing but problems in an effort to communicate. If all you ever talk about are problems, all you'll ever have are problem relationships. Don't just communicate when there's trouble and when you're upset with one another or disappointed with something that has taken place. Some families fail to talk or even communicate at all, something that causes far more problems than you might imagine. My clinical research shows that the amount of trouble kids get into is inversely proportional to the number of words spoken in the home. What that means is, the less you talk at home, the more trouble your kids get in outside the home. Therefore, we need to encourage active communication in our families. Here are several strategies for doing so in your own family. Talk about things that don't matter. This is a useful expression for saying talk about the little things, such as what went on in your day or in your child's day. This approach has the value of keeping the lines of communication open, especially when there's trouble or during an emergency. There's a useful analogy in medicine to illustrate what I'm talking about. If you've ever been taken to the emergency room, hospitalized, or been with someone who has, maybe you've noticed that one of the very first procedures administered is the insertion of an IV line. This is done quickly so that there's already an IV in place in case the patient has something like a grand mal seizure. The channel, the line to the vein, is already open and medicine can be injected directly into the bloodstream. They've got a flow going. In a similar way, when it's time to talk about something really serious to your child, the lines of communication are already open. How do you ever expect to talk to them about things that do matter if you haven't practiced talking to them about things that don't? The more you talk to each other, the stronger your bond becomes. You meet on a completely different plane that does nothing but help your relationship. Change the backdrop or the context in which that communication occurs. You'll find that your children are much more comfortable, more receptive, and tend to open up in safe environments, rather than if you sit them down in a chair or at a table to talk. Suffice it to say, this serves only to make them defensive and suspicious, and they'll disconnect from you. Under these circumstances, what is real never gets voiced, and what gets voiced is never real. Let me give you an example of how active communication is enhanced when you're in an environment in which your child feels comfortable. My son Jordan and I frequently play video football, a game at which I start slow and taper off. I don't have a clue how to generate extra points, and half the time I'm holding the controller upside down. I don't have to tell you that he pummels me every single time and gets a big kick out of administering each whooping. However, the game becomes the backdrop for some very important conversations in which he shares some of his innermost thoughts. Listening to CDs with your children, going with them to get their car gas, playing games together, these modes of relating break down walls, giving both of you a much more rewarding outcome than trying to force communication. You'll get more information and greater bonding as long as you don't interrogate or give your child the third degree. Make time to talk in the car while playing games before bedtime. The point is to make a conscious effort to look for times when you can talk to your child alone. Tune in to your child's world. When there's something your child is doing that at first you may not understand, your very first step should not be to judge or criticize. Your first step should be to tune in. If your 14-year-old son likes rap music, for instance, and it's music that's not banned from the radio, meet him where he is. If my son buys some new CDs, I want to talk about that. It's not the music that's important to me. What's important to me is that it's important to him. Tune in not only to his musical taste and purchases, but also to everything in which he's involved and interested in. Favorite subject at school, favorite website, his friends, and so forth. Know what is going on in your children's lives and in their hearts and minds. Then make a commitment to be actively interested in each other's lives. If you want to have mutual interest, you have to be mutually available. Discuss sensitive subjects such as politics or religion. These discussions are for the sole purpose of teaching children how to express their opinions and to learn how to communicate. It is not a debate, but rather an opportunity for children to feel free to articulate opinions without criticism. Providing a forum for your child's self-expression is one of the ways you can bolster their self-confidence and enhance their communication skills. Do some quilting. This is actually a term I use to describe family interactions involving a common activity. Originally, quilting was a project usually done by a group of women or members of a family as part of a quilting bee, where patches were sewn together to make a quilt. The object of quilting is to begin a group project together, not necessarily quilting, but in the general spirit of the quilting bee. Examples of quilting projects include painting a room, cleaning the house, washing the car, making a dollhouse, building a playhouse or a treehouse, or tending a garden. Quilting is an excellent way to create opportunities for communication and bring the family together for a project. We'll go into more detail when we talk about communication as a parenting tool later in this audiobook. Begin right now to prioritize active, ongoing communication into your family life, even if you're the one who must initiate it. It will strengthen your family relationships, build bridges between you and other family members, and help nurture the authenticity of every child in your family. Factor number 5, learn how to manage a crisis. When it comes to family life, it's not a question of whether or not a family crisis will hit. It's a question of when. No matter how smoothly your life goes, no matter how well you parent with a purpose, you'll encounter some crisis and it will impact your life together as a family. Maybe you discover that your child is addicted to drugs or alcohol, or your family must adjust to life with a chronically ill child or parent. Perhaps your family is dealing with your divorce, or you find evidence that your child is identifying with some counterculture like goth. Maybe your son is on a failure track at school. There are endless challenges that can and will pop up because life is not a success-only journey. An important hallmark of phenomenal families is that they don't panic or turn on one another when the pressure is on. Phenomenal families are loyal to one another and emerge from the other side of the crisis stronger and more bonded than ever. Some crises are of our own making. Others intrude on families from the world. No matter what the origin, a crisis is a wake-up call that something is wrong in your family and can threaten its viability. And remember that certain events may not seem like a crisis to you as a parent, but may be of monumental enormity in the eyes of a child. There are some families who, when confronted by a crisis, are prone to panic, decompensate, or fall apart. When facing challenges, these families are handicapped by self-limiting beliefs. Those beliefs are extremely important because I believe that people create the results in life that they believe they deserve. If you're a parent who believes peace and tranquility and all good things in life are meant for other people, people who deserve the good things, then your family is doomed to a painful existence. This type of parent simply holds on to the belief that any crisis is too overwhelming and impossible to handle. They surrender to a negative result with no fight or resistance. On the other hand, I'm sure you've seen other families who deal with a shattering crisis in a constructive manner. They view the crisis as a manageable challenge, sharing the conviction, "We believe we deserve to survive intact, and we will find a way." As a result, they are better equipped to find workable solutions and less likely to overlook alternatives that can be incredibly powerful. These families have the skills to move through the crisis and come out stronger than ever, with greater attention to what matters, a refocus on priorities, a clearer moral compass, and heightened sense of purpose in their lives or family relationships that are more loving than they might have otherwise been. Know this, you do have a choice about whether the crisis will be your family's absolute undoing or whether it becomes a time for your family to rally, emerge strengthened, and create value from adversity. The worst of times can bring out your family's best. Your best chance to navigate the rough waters of a crisis is to have a consciously designed crisis management plan well in place for overcoming the tough stuff before it hits. Earlier in my career, I had the privilege of being professionally involved in aviation, a love of mine from an early age. As a human factors consultant for various airlines, reconstructing psychological circumstances leading to airline disasters. As a matter of crisis management, the aviation industry adopted what was referred to as a cockpit resource management plan, which included a very specific emergency procedure. The key was that the emergency plan was decided upon well in advance of a flight crew ever getting into an emergency. The reason for this should be obvious. The time to decide what to do when you have an engine fire is not when you have an engine fire. The time to decide that is ahead of time. Pilots have access to a thick 2,000-page manual that describes what to do in any kind of an emergency. But as you might suspect, they don't have time to thumb through a manual to find out how to climb out of trouble. They don't even rely on memory. Instead, they have a very few lines of emergency instructions in boldface attached to the instrument panel. It tells them exactly what to do in a crisis. They can therefore react to problems in a timely fashion. I'm convinced that families should have a similar crisis management plan. Bullet point lines stating exactly what your family will do when things get out of control every time something goes wrong in the family, written down so that you do not even have to think. The time to do this is now. Your bold-faced plan might include any number of the following. Be prepared before a crisis strikes. The crucial thing about crisis is preparation. The printout material of this audiobook contains a list of hot warning signs. These are some of the clues that you may have a crisis on your hands or that one is brewing. Study this list. As a parent, stay alert to these early warning signs. Ignoring these signs could mean a tragic outcome for your child or your family. Stay calm. No matter how you feel when a crisis hits, you must remain calm. Stay in charge of yourself, and this will inspire confidence and reassurance in the rest of your family. Do deep breathing exercises if you have to, since these will fuel your brain with more oxygen for clearer thinking and better decision-making. Remove danger. This might mean calling the police yourself, confiscating dangerous things, keeping your child from having contact with certain people, or removing him from a dangerous place physically or emotionally, or keeping him away from a dangerous person. Work the problem, not the person. This is one of the most powerful tools you have at your disposal to manage and overcome the crisis. Never attack or blame the family member in crisis. When you're upset with a child, it can be terribly tempting to blame or criticize them. But when you choose to blame a child in trouble, that child learns to cover his tracks the next time he gets in trouble. And trust me, he will get in trouble again, since crisis-prone behavior that goes unresolved does nothing but compound. By aiming your energies at solving the problem instead, you ensure that you're not just spinning your wheels and that you're working the crisis from a solution standpoint rather than indicting the person with blame and isolated punishment. Just by putting that simple control on your family life, working the problem and the crisis, not the person, you've made another gigantic step toward building a phenomenal family. Close ranks. When a crisis erupts, family members tend to turn on one another, blaming or ripping into someone with personal attacks. Once this spirit takes over, relating stops and the destruction of family relationships starts. Never, ever turn on one another, put family relationships on the line, or cave into pressure. Instead, close ranks and support one another. You must resolve that your relationships will exist on a level above blame and personal attacks. If family members are unable to turn to one another, a crisis will shatter family unity and make it practically impossible to get through troubled times together. Communicate. For a family in crisis, communication is vital. Be honest and encourage an environment of openness. The best way to accomplish this is simply to stop talking and start listening. Give your child your undivided attention. Listen to your child and his or her story, or listen to the authorities and their viewpoint. Let your children freely ask questions and reward their questions with such words as, "I'm glad you came to me with that question." Tell them too, "I'm here for you to answer your questions and your concerns." When you do speak, the actual words you use are less important than the attitude you convey. The attitude you should adopt is one of hope for the resolution of the crisis and love for your child, no matter what. Reassure the family member in crisis that the home environment is a safe place where the family cares about him or her. You may not like what the child did. You certainly don't endorse failing grades, drug abuse, promiscuity, or whatever the crisis is. And you do hold your child accountable for his or her behavior. But he knows you are going to help him damage control the situation. In fact, no one should tolerate any overtly maladaptive behavior, such as physical violence, mental or emotional abuse, and certainly no substance abuse in a healthy family. If the wheels come off, they will come off, but you're going to stand by your child during the crisis and help him get through it. You're a resource for your children. Tell your child, "You're cared for, you are my first priority, and you will be protected." In addition, convey to your family, "Life will not be like this forever. Our family will heal." Maintain a degree of normalcy. You may not be able to do everything you used to do, but try to keep your normal daily routines and familiar rituals as much as possible. This will have a calming, stabilizing effect on the rest of your family. Contact and use the resources you have. Your family does not have to go through a crisis alone. Draw on resources such as pastor, minister, rabbi, or spiritual leader, other family members, your child's teachers, school psychologist or counselor, your child's pediatrician, local support groups, or your state or county mental health association. These resources will assist you in identifying and implementing constructive solutions. Let them help you. Be open to all solutions, even things you might initially want to dismiss. Just because you don't agree wholeheartedly with an avenue of approach doesn't mean it might not work in your family. Don't slam the door on certain alternatives or even coping tools such as tension-reducing activities without exploring them completely first. Maybe you think they won't help or that they won't work. But what if something like this is exactly what you need when a crisis strikes? What if it is? Please understand, now is not the time to be judgmental, resisting some tools and resources that may genuinely help you. If you downplay this now, you may be cheating your family later. Don't worry about the future. Stop asking yourself, what if something else happens again? Remember that something traumatic happened and you got through it. If something else happens, you'll get through that too. Find meaning to your suffering. Don't allow yourself to be devastated for no reason, no meaning, and no purpose. You've got to create some value to the pain that you experience in your life. I'm not suggesting that one of your choices is to decide that anything that may happen in your life is positive. Obviously, that's not always a rational reaction. Should some injury or tragedy befall one of your children or another family member, you may choose to learn from the event and thereby protect him or her and your other children more effectively in the future. You may choose to see that your child learns to deal with and overcome adversity. You may choose to help those who are further back down the trail than you are. You may choose to take some social action in order to create meaning out of suffering and to change the situation in which the crisis took place, thereby protecting other families. If you use your pain and what you've been through in your life, you create value from adversity. As you begin to fold these five factors for a phenomenal family into your family life, let's have some fun and also signal to the family members that things are different. Sometimes even the simplest things can get your family's attention and make them aware that they are in fact entering a new day and a new time. Here are a few simple but tried and proven suggestions for signaling change in your day-to-day family life. These admittedly superficial changes are of no particular consequence other than they get everyone else's attention and let everyone know that your family is doing things differently starting today. Start with this short list of suggestions and feel free to have some fun and add some of your own. For example, have your kids switch rooms. Serve dinner in the dining room instead of at the kitchen table or bar. Paint your living room or den a new color. Get a different haircut. Play music in your house instead of watching constant television. Rearrange the furniture in your house. If you commit to and are able to bring these five factors to life in your own family, you will see amazing progress in the quality of your family life and interconnectedness. If despite your best efforts, you simply can't get traction to create the change that you want, be patient. You may think that you're changing your behavior as well as the characteristics and nuances of your family environment when in fact you're really not. For example, you may feel you've become emotionally available and that you've changed your interactions with your family for the better. Others may disagree, however. So please stay patient. You must work hard to incorporate these factors into your family. It is a process that takes commitment and persistence. Be honest with yourself, and if you're still struggling, go on alert to the fact that you or some other family member may be experiencing more than just a lack of knowledge about how to create healthy family behavior. You may be suffering from deeply entrenched, serious conflicts or pain from your life that are blocking your ability to implement these five factors. You cannot give away what you don't have, and these five factors are all about giving. If such is the case with you or one of your children, this too is under your control. Even though such barriers may exist outside your conscious awareness, your inability to bring about meaningful change in a timely fashion should be a clue. Your accountability extends to reaching out for additional help. As the leader of your family, it is your job to do what it takes to create what you want. A well-chosen psychologist, psychiatrist, social worker, or pastoral counselor could be just the spark plug you need to create the five factors as realities in your home. You can do this. My goal in this chapter has been to provide you with factors made up of thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that can be created by you for your family from the inside out. In the next chapter, we will be talking about some important aspects of your learning history that may be contributing to or contaminating your family life. The truth is, there may be internal barriers, but the first place I would look is your family legacy. Approach the next chapter with an open mind and a willingness to consider both the pros and cons of your upbringing. As you take a close look at your family legacy, we'll identify the gifts you receive from your parents as well as the contaminants they may have visited upon you. Getting familiar with these aspects of your family life will be action-filled and will make your journey through this audiobook exciting, eye-opening, and infinitely rewarding for you as a parent. Keep this in mind. Let the destination we're headed for always be the creation of your phenomenal family.
Chapter 4, Your Family Legacy.
You now know that there are five factors for a phenomenal family, each with a clear series of actions designed to bring these factors alive in your deserving family. The next logical step is to assess whether aspects of your upbringing sabotages or facilitates your ability to implement them. A particularly wise poet, and obviously a highly observant parent, once wrote, "Children learn what they live." No truer words have ever been put down on paper. You are who you are today in large part due to the impact your parents had, and still have, on your life. How many times have you jokingly or otherwise said, "Lord, please don't let me become my mother." We all say it, even if we love our mothers deeply. The truth is, we are prone to reflecting in our current day lives the very values, thoughts, actions, and beliefs that were so consistently modeled for us by our parents. Some of what they modeled was good and worthy of embracing, but some of it was not. Our parents' impact ranged from the powerfully overt to the profoundly subtle, from the solid and sound to the sick and destructive. Perhaps surprisingly, it is the subtle, the less obvious parental influences that are most likely to have seeped undetected into your thoughts, feelings, beliefs, and behaviors. I strongly suspect that you'll find evidence of those subtle influences even in your physical mannerisms, such as hand gestures, the way you walk, the way you tilt your head, or your voice intonation. In the same way, I'll bet there are certain words or phrases that you say exactly the way your mother or father said them. You may find yourself in certain events or circumstances that are so reminiscent of your childhood, you can almost see and hear your mother or father as you speak or react in the here and now. So many of your behaviors, as a parent and otherwise, can be traced back to your growing up years, when you lived with your parents. Is this some great revelation? Of course it isn't. Everybody knows that our parents have an impact on who and what we become. You know you're like your mother or father. You've probably said over and over again, "I'm doing exactly what my parents did, and I hate that." The reason I'm including this discussion here and now is because I want you to take that common sense awareness to the next level of specificity and understanding. I want you to bring your upbringing to the center stage of your consciousness so that you can actively deal with it and not parent with blinders on. I don't want you to just acknowledge that your parents probably shaped who you have become in general and who you have become as a parent in particular and leave it at that. I'm challenging you to identify with great detail exactly what values, beliefs, characteristics, traits, and behaviors have been passed on to you as a function of your experiences with your own parents. I don't want this to be a philosophical exercise. I want this to be an action-oriented plan for specific and lasting change. Only when you identify and isolate the elements of your family legacy can you create an action-oriented to-do list for positive change. The trick is to zero in on and separate the negative influences from the positive ones so you can nurture some and eradicate others. As I said earlier, I was greatly frustrated by my father's alcoholism and the personality traits that he exhibited when he was drinking. I hated every second of it, and at times hated him for what he was doing to me and to our family. When he was drinking, he was selfish, rude, insensitive, and at times plain mean-spirited. I was humiliated by his conduct and lived in constant fear that he would further embarrass us all. I responded by being withdrawn, guarded, and cynical. I don't want to carry those traits, attitudes, and fears on to my own family now. I've had to single out those experiences and guard against their influence on me in the here and now. But, and this is a big but, he also modeled for me an amazing work ethic and an unwavering devotion to protecting our family from dangerous people, places, and events. He would never say something couldn't be done and was intimidated by no man or challenge. He was an absolute romantic with my mother and often made sacrifices for us all that he probably thought went unnoticed. They did not. He taught me to lead my family and to cherish my wife, even though he sometimes failed in all the above. His striving was inspirational, and I am a better man for having been exposed to his good qualities, and even better for being aware of and eliminating his negative ones. Although many childhood experiences may have been of short duration, they could have very well had powerful lasting effects, and certain here and now experiences can take us